This is January 29th, 2017. Apologies for sounding a little congested. Still wrapping up a cold. If it's any consolation, it sounds worse than it feels. I'm going to talk today about identity. Identity in the fundamental Buddhist understanding of no self. Identity got a lot of play through the election season. It's all about identity. If you listen to the news, gender identity, racial identity, black identity, white identity, ethnic identity, political identity, national identity, class identity. Identity is a central part of being human, but it can wreak all kinds of havoc in our minds and in our hearts. So I found three articles that I'm going to read from, parts of. The first one must have been in my files for years. It's from a magazine called The Quest of Winter 1988. The name of it is On the Virtue of Not Knowing Who You Are. Mm-hmm. And it's by Philip Novak, who at the time, in 1988, was an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Dominican College in California, San Rafael, California. This article was first delivered at a conference convened by the Sri Lankan Buddhist scholar Padmasiri da Silva. it's a long article. I'll only be reading parts of it, and it's can get pretty dense philosophically, conceptually, but it is brilliant, I think. I just discovered it last night. I thought, where have you been all my life with this article? And so I ask your patience and attention. Some articles lend themselves better to being read aloud than others, and this would be a little bit challenging, but I'll try to make it understandable. So he begins, "The problem of identity. Let us begin by remembering that we are creatures of desire. There pulses in and through us and through all living forms a basic urge to be, to continue experiencing." This is pure Buddhism, by the way. St. Thomas Aquinas called it the desiderium natural. Spinoza called it the conatus. And the Buddha called it the bhavatanna, the desire of living things to persist and expand their being. By the way, this is right at the very heart of Buddhist teaching and the human nature, the desire to persist, to go on living, the desire to be and expand our being. He goes on, "Every human being born into this world longs to be special, a unique center of importance and value, a possessor of life's fullness. The task of responding to this ontic given," ontology is the being, the matter of being, the task of responding to this matter of being is the problem of identity. He traces the origination and the development of this. It is a problem because very early on in human life, the human child begins to receive disconcerting indications that she, I'm just going to say she every time instead of he, she, indications that she is not the center of the universe, she feels herself to be. Psychologists suspect that for a while anyway, the infant lives in a magical, self-enclosed world in which all surroundings are extensions of the child's own center. But all too soon, the child begins to collide with real existential limits in a world where she is decidedly not the center. The die is cast. Here begins the agonizing struggle for a secure identity, for life beyond death, for inviolable self-esteem. Make no mistake, long before the child's mind ponders the nature of physical death, her viscera know the nauseating taste of death resulting from a blow to her identity. The bigger stick of candy given to one's brother, being chosen last in the choosing of sides for a game. These and a thousand other indications hiss, "You dispensable nobody," searing his guts. Nor do these dread hints of one's insignificance diminish with the passing of time. William James saw how they continue into adult life and how their constancy must be thought to shape some of the psyche's deepest predispositions. And then these are the words he quotes of William James: "Failure, then failure, so the world stamps us at every turn. We strew it with our blunders, our misdeeds, our lost opportunities, with all the memorials of our inadequacy to our vocation. And with what a damning emphasis does it blot us out. The subtlest forms of suffering known to man are connected with the poisonous humiliations incidental to these results, and they are pivotal human experiences. A process so ubiquitous and everlasting is evidently an integral part of life." Let me just say, when people formally become my student in a ceremony, I always invite them to compose a brief autobiographical sketch that emphasizes in particular the things that they saw as having maybe led them eventually to practice. And I always say, for a lot of us, most of us, I'd suggest, for most of us, it is the losses, the crises in our lives. And then he says, "As I owe a debt to Ernest Becker in my setting up of the problem of identity, let us hear from him directly. Man is in an almost constant struggle not to be diminished in his organismic importance. This struggle is carried on the most minute levels of symbolic complexity. To be outshone by another is to be attacked at some basic level of organismic durability. To lose, to be second rate, and fail to keep up, sends a message to the nerve center of the organism's anxiety. I am overshadowed, inadequate. Hence, I do not qualify for continued durability, for life, for eternity. Hence, I will die." The problem of identity, then, is chronic. No one in the process of growing up escapes the little diminishments which deep inside echo an insidious reminder of our potential non-being. From the resulting anxiety comes a drivenness, admitting of infinite guises and degrees, to prove to oneself that one is a somebody and not a nobody, that one has a unique identity, a special gift to offer the world, and is a being of worth and significance. Society becomes a stage for identity quests, for the battle to win inviolable self-esteem and thus secure confirmation of oneself as a vital organism. It is an organized set of practices, games, and laws whereby each individual can try to find ways of confirming individual value and worth. I'm not so sure this would be so strong in people of other countries. I think or put it this way, I think this is especially strong in us Americans, because our sense of identity is so determined by, so conditioned by the sense of individuality. Whereas in other countries, especially Asian countries, one's sense of identity is much more tied to the collective, the we. We Japanese, we Chinese. It's more the national or family, and less the individual identity that we have so strongly here in this country. Here, then, is the struggle of life against death, which for the human being, the symbolic animal, becomes primarily the struggle for identity and against contingency. The struggle of I for I against the threatening that, or the other. This word contingency, the struggle for identity and against contingency. I would just take that to mean struggle against the sense of one's identity being subject to change and threatened by our impermanence, maybe. The child learns two basic strategies to enhance personal significance, and these set the pattern for all future adaptations. One is to develop self-powers, both physical and mental, to experience the exhilaration of personal talents, and more importantly, to win with them the approval and acclaim of others. Let's call this the self-assertive strategy. The other is to link oneself via what psychologists call transference, to link oneself to sources of life or power outside oneself. For lack of a better term, let's call this the self-subordinative strategy. So self-assertive and self-subordinative strategy. No one lives long without a terrifying glimpse of the paucity of one's self-powers, and it is only natural to want to hitch your wagon to a star. The child's first stars are its parents, their great aura of power and invincibility dominating the childhood horizon. But soon the child, and then the adult, will psychically link himself to other higher powers and sources of life. Teachers and other authorities, movie stars, leaders, and other mana personalities, religious credos, political causes, the homeland, the lover, the bank balance. By linking our identity to these, life can be enhanced, expanded, shored up against the threat of non-being. The myriad programs of the human biocomputer become linked by a fundamental theme, desire for and attachment to any thought or experience which affirms the self and enhances its will to be, and defense against and aversion for those thoughts and experiences which impress upon it its contingency and mortality. The psyche becomes a multidimensional webwork of likes and dislikes. Does that sound familiar? Likes and dislikes, desires and aversions, both gross and subtle, which manifest the personality in the same way that black and white dots can create the illusion of a face. By the time one is old enough to even begin to become aware of the unconscious compulsions within one's identity project, one is already deeply enmeshed in them with little chance to escape their automatism. The continuing need for secure identity unfolds into an egocentric system in which one's beliefs, feelings, experiences, perceptions, and behaviors are automatically viewed and assessed around one's sense of value and worth as an individual. By the way, I think a lot of this would be seen by most Americans as utterly radical, maybe even incomprehensible, so deep is our assumption of self, that the I, the me, and the my as something to expand and develop and elevate and so forth. Out of the egocentric whirlpool comes a troublesome precipitate we may call the self-image. This is what often in spiritual practice we refer to as the ego. It's a self-concept or self-image. It exists as a subsystem within the larger system of the psyche, a relatively stable eddy within the psychic stream. We may define it as the set of all those features, whether real or imagined, which the individual believes his or her identity to reside. Here we are at the nub of the problem. For as we shall see, Buddhism does not object to having an identity and a sense of self-worth, but only to identity grasping and to the wholly mistaken equation of identity with the self-image. This is an important point. Let me reread it. Buddhism does not object to having an identity and a sense of self-worth, but only objects to identity grasping and to the wholly mistaken equation of identity with the self-image. He talks just a little bit, introduces the idea of boundaries between self and other. He says, boundaries require defenses, and defenses require energy. Spending too much energy on defense is another name for neurosis. In any case, the more we defend our self-image, the more brittle it becomes and the more defense it requires. Let me just insert what I've said so often from this seat. Our self-image is just an aggregate, a conglomerate of memories and thoughts and images that have built up over our lifetime. That's the ego. That's the self, what we call the self, small s self. The more we defend it, the more brittle it becomes, and the more defense it requires. The more we shore up our identity with material and psychological possessions, in quotation marks, the more their ephemerality excites anxiety about our ultimate security. To attempt to establish an identity by building up the self-image is like trying to solve a problem of being by some mode of having. The two are incommensurable. As the self-image arises from a false view of the nature of the self, the possibilities for change that are consistent with it only serve to aggravate the false views at its root. This vicious, self-perpetuating circle is known in Buddhism as samsara. The only way out of it is not some final possession or some ultimate defense, for there are none, but a life and practice that will promote the realization that self and other are non-different, or to put it another way, that the self which one is trying to save from death is in reality but an interdependent flicker of light in Indra's shining net, a wave in the birthless and deathless ocean of being. And then just a little more here, a very important addition to what this case he's making. By the time one is old enough to be able to consciously adopt Buddhism as a way of life and thought, one already has the contours of the identity problem deeply etched into one's psyche. We are all aware that Buddhist practice is a means to eradicate false views of the nature of the self, and as such is primarily a destructive opus. It destroys the afflictions or the hindrances. It dissolves the three poisons of greed, anger, and delusion. It reveals the non-self characteristic of reality. But the hunger for identity does not vanish overnight. Nor does one go from being bound up in identity clinging to being free of such clinging in a day. The Buddhist path is a developmental one, and I want to suggest that Buddhism must offer interim identities to the aspirant, so that as old, inauthentic self-images fall away, more authentic ones take their place as progress is made toward final liberation. Buddhist practice, I am suggesting, has a constructive aspect that satisfies the human hunger for identity even while the causes of that hunger are being gradually eroded. And he goes on to say, and I won't read much more, that this interim identity that we can use as skillful means to keep us on the path, this interim identity, he sees as based on the three jewels of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha is obvious, you know, if we can learn to believe, have faith in our Buddha nature, our true self, capital S self, and then as well the Dharma and the Sangha, then this can carry us through the process of deconstructing this false sense of self. Implicit in the Buddhist aspirant's embrace of the path, of the way, as that alone which may be able to satisfy her heart's longing, is the understanding of the unsatisfactoriness, inauthenticity, and insufficiency of many of these cultural idols. Well, he mentioned them earlier, all the my. But does this not mean that as soon as one has dharmic intent, that one is suddenly free of the deeply ingrained reflex to create idols, to link oneself to superior powers in one's quest for identity? Oh, it does not mean that, nor does Buddhism wish it so. Behold, it too offers refuge for the significant seeking self, three of them in fact, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. What a rich field in which to assume a new identity. The aspirant's very will is fueled by images of personal greatness and nobility. I want to be an enlightened one. I want to join the holy company of enlightened ones. I want to be a bodhisattva and give my life for the liberation of all sentient beings. It is precisely such notions that form the nucleus of a general intentionality that will continue to exert a positive, constructive influence in the aspirant's life. For by weaning oneself away from the individualistic identity images toward more archetypal and transpersonal ones, the Buddhist taps rich sources of psychic energy and inspiration. And here, by the way, is an argument for embracing not just Zen as a meditation practice, but Zen Buddhism. Buddhism understands that the ongoing health of the personality depends upon sufficient self-esteem. The wearing of robes, the chanting of sutras, the taking of vows, wonderful, skillful means, all of them. As old images of who one is fall away, these new identities sustain one. A bodhisattva is a nice thing to be. And now, on to this doctrine of no self. here's something that I would ask everyone, every one of you, to try to memorize, which is, I've mentioned it many times in Taisho, is the three characteristics of existence. So these three characteristics of existence, in other words, the nature of reality, is impermanent, suffering, and no self. I sometimes mention these at introductory workshops, And I know no one's going to give me an argument about impermanence. Who's going to say that things are permanent, that nothing ever changes in the slightest way? So that one, check. Suffering, who's going to say that they have no suffering or anyone else has? It's pervasive. It's a condition of human existence, is this dukkha, suffering. Okay, that one, check. But no self? This is a tall order to have people, especially beginners who haven't done the meditation, it's a tall order to ask them to swallow this doctrine of no self. And so with this this prefatory material I just read from this philosopher, this professor of philosophy, now I'm going to go on to talk more about how we might, those who haven't realized through enlightenment, who have not realized the truth of no self, might wrap their minds around this better. No self doesn't mean a lack of continuity. Of course, we have a certain way in which this body-mind complex and our personality and our character have a continuity to them, physically. Of course, we look at old photographs. They're largely, we can recognize, unless they're very old, we can recognize ourselves or others physically, in personality, in character. There's a continuity to what we call the self. The problem comes when we think that that's an absolute, unchanging, permanent self. That's the delusion, is that we're unchanging. You see how this teaching of no self is sort of another aspect of the teaching of impermanence. So two of the three characteristics of existence are very intimately related: impermanence and no self. I'll be reading from an article by Joseph Goldstein, a senior American Theravadan teacher, one who I have a lot of respect for. This is an article from Inquiring Mind. It's it's the kind of the one of the big Theravadan Buddhist periodicals, but this is from, let's see, 21 years ago, 22 years ago, spring of 1995. I've been saving it up for this very Tay show. Now he talks about this, how there is a continuity to our being that is not a matter of being a fixed self or having some substance. And the simile that he gives is when we think of a seed becoming a sapling and then becoming a tree which bears fruit, we find a continuity in that process, even though there is no single element which is carried through from the seed to the fruit. The seed does not move up through the trunk of the tree into the fruit. It's a lawful process of becoming, but there is no single element or self carried through. So when we say no self, it's a little misleading. The original Pali word that the Buddha used is anatta, which means selflessness. Because the Buddha never said flatly and in any kind of absolute way, there is no self. Because there is a kind of a self in the sense that there's continuity, but it's no permanent fixed self. And then he lays out these different, what he calls many skillful means for realizing selflessness, anatta. And this is where I think he distinguishes his own tradition, the Theravadan Buddhism, from Zen Buddhism, because he offers contemplative practices, ways of sort of getting your mind around this concept of selflessness. One way he offers is the practices of the Brahma Viharas. Brahma Vihara means the divine abodes. And there are four of these. Some of you will remember this. The four are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Love is metta, loving kindness. Compassion is karuna. Joy is upekka, mudita, and equanimity is upekka. And the idea is that by cultivating these states of mind, we create a mental environment which actually allows for an understanding of emptiness. But that's still a kind of a meditation that is not like Zen. In Zen, we are trying to empty the mind of all concepts, even these exalted concepts of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. This is, I think, the hallmark of Zen meditation as compared to other forms of Buddhist meditation, is this emptying the mind. In Zen, there is this underlying faith that if we can empty the mind and restore it to its original state of purity, then our innate loving kindness will be liberated, start to function. And the same with compassion and joy and equanimity. He says that when we work with selflessness, anatta, it is important for us to realize that the self is not something bad that we need to get rid of. And I would just say, it was never there in the first place. That's the illusion. And it's a big mistake when we enter practice and start making war on the self. We're making war on a phantom, an illusion. It's a waste of energy to become self-critical. Then he says, what is essential is to see how the belief in self is continuously being created in different moments. The process becomes very clear in meditation. And then he lays this out for us. In meditation practice, we notice that phenomena arise at all the sense doors, mind included. The sense doors are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. We notice that phenomena, just to be clear about this word phenomena, because it's so abstract, phenomena is basically everything. Everything physical, everything mental, emotional, conceptual, imaginary, it's all phenomena. Everything, you can't point to anything that's not phenomena, except by saying that which is beyond phenomena. So we notice that phenomena arise at all the sense doors, mind included. If we are mindful, then there's no problem, because all things are understood as impermanent, arising out of conditions. When we are not mindful, however, we become identified with the different phenomena that arise, that is, physical sensations or thoughts or emotions. We become identified with them. Sometimes we become identified with the objects that arise, and sometimes with the knower or the knowing of them. It is at that very moment of identification that creates the sense of self. And then he goes on to say that the experience of no self, selflessness can have different flavors. And this is what I found most helpful when I first read this article a long time ago. So the different flavors of no self. The first comes from the deconstruction of the idea of self. This process, and it's a process, it's a contemplative process, using the mind, which is not Zen, strictly speaking. This process leads to the understanding that what we call self, or I, is simply the appearance of the five skandhas. You all know this word, or heard of this word, from the Prajnaparamita, Bodhisattva of compassion, from the depths of Prajna wisdom, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. These skandhas are what's said to be the constituents of personal identity. Form, which is the body, feeling, thought or perceptions, choice or volition, will, and then consciousness. This is so hard to get clear on this. I'm still in the process of getting clear on these five skandhas, so I won't dwell on that, but just this is basic Buddhist teaching, that we are composed of these things. He says, as an analogy, if we see a rainbow, we can realize that it's just an appearance due to certain conditions of light and moisture. It does not exist independent of those conditions. We can look at all the constituent elements of what we call self in the same way. I've mentioned this one, my own, that occurred to me as I was driving by buildings that were, well, it was Wegmans on East Avenue a few years ago. They tore it down and rebuilt it. And in the process of tearing it, or not Wegmans itself, but the buildings next to the Wegmans on East Avenue, there were these row of buildings that they took down. And in the process of taking them down, and I drive by there every day, you see they take off the sides, they take off the roof. Little by little, those old buildings were deconstructed. You get down to the I-beams, the pillars, and then even those come down. At what point is it no longer a building? At some point, it's gone eventually. So that's kind of my own way of understanding more of these aggregates, that each one of us, what we think of as the self, is just these aggregates that come together. And he talks about another way to understand selflessness is through the experience of impermanence, either on a microscopic or on a macroscopic level. And he's suggesting that when we think back to something that happened 10 years ago, or even 1 year ago, or even 10 minutes ago, where is it now? There's nothing to be found. We see the insubstantiality of phenomena and realize that nothing lasts long enough to be called a self. So this is a little different than mentally deconstructing the self into the five aggregates. This is very compelling, but it still involves thought. I'm thinking, okay, even my memories are present. We think of our memories as in the past. Well, there's no past right now. Where's the past? Except in our memories. Our thoughts, memories are thought forms. There's just this. Things, another word Buddhist word is the evanescence of things, that things are in flux. And this, we have the confirmation of modern physics and medical science that nothing, there is no thing that is perfectly, absolutely unchanging, moment by moment. millisecond by millisecond. In terms of the self, our physical body, the cells are dividing and dying and being reborn, and millisecond by millisecond, we are, each one of us is just energy in flux. We're shimmering. We don't see ourselves shimmering because we don't have that faculty of our sight. But everything, not just us, not just people and dogs and cats and mice, but things, tables, cushions, altars, Buddha figures, everything is shimmering. And then he offers another way to understand selflessness. It comes from the experience of things being ungovernable, of things happening by themselves, or due to multiple causes. He says, phenomena are not subject to our will. We can't say, body, don't die. We can't say, everything stop. Phenomena follow their own laws according to their own natures, and we can either be in accord with them or not. In either case, there is no self in charge of the world. This is liberating, if we can ever realize this, that this is not our burden to think that we need to control what happens. We engage with the world. We do our best to respond to the world, especially to suffering as we can. But never imagine that there is some little man in here or a little woman in there who's is responsible for controlling everything. This is a delusion. And this becomes a great milestone in one's practice when you realize that really it's practice comes down to getting out of the way of realizing that all we have to do is let go of our self-concern, which often means our concern about thoughts about our practice and our progress or lack of progress, and above all, let go of our thoughts about ourself. If we can do that, and we get out of the way and things flow, things move along, they unfold as they need to. There's no self in charge of the world. Again, to realize no self, this selflessness, we're not trying to deny our personality, our character, even our identity, however we may imagine that. We're not trying to convince ourselves that we're a non-personality, a non-person, but just to bring awareness to things as they are. That's the meditation. The worst kind of self-concern is the thought, and this is a deep one, the thought that I'm a deluded person, I'm an unenlightened, and I want to someday become enlightened. If I work hard enough, then I can become something else. That's the mistake. That's the delusion. It's thoughts. When we're free of thoughts, it's not there. And then we are manifesting our innate enlightenment when there are no such thoughts of duality, enlightened and unenlightened. So always in Zen, we come back to the meditation itself. Self-reflections that Joseph Goldstein mentions, thinking about this and that, these three, what he calls flavors of selflessness. Okay, I'm sure that works to some extent, but it's different from Zen, or at least orthodox, pure Zen meditation, where we're just paying attention to the mind, paying attention to things as they are now, the present. Because when we're caught in our wandering mind, we lose ourselves. We just go from one thought to another. We just get carried away. We go off on a train of thoughts. But to choose where our attention is directed, that's what Zazen comes down to. The important thing is not the content of the thought, or even the quality of it, whether it's stupid or intelligent, right or wrong, but the attention, the ability to notice, to see, to listen to the thoughts, and therefore, in that way, to become aware of them. It's all about awareness. Over and over and over again, we come to this word awareness or noticing. That's it. If someone asks you what is meditation anyway, well, that's a good way to start. Bring up something about awareness or noticing, not just the mind. That's what we're doing in particular when we're sitting, but at all times to notice phenomena, everything around us, everyone around us. Then we can learn to relax into this realm of no thought, this realm of silence, and to trust it, not just while sitting, but in our daily life, to trust this realm of no thought. This is another guy, another teacher I respect a lot, a Theravadan teacher, who last I heard was living in England, Ajahn Sumedho. Just a little bit from his article about no self. He says, when the self starts to break up, some people find it very frightening. Everything you have regarded as solid and real starts falling apart. I remember years ago, long before I was a Buddhist, feeling threatened by certain radical ideas that tended to challenge the security of the world I lived in. At times such as those, it seems that somebody is threatening or challenging something that you depend upon for your sense that everything is all right. You can get very angry and even violent because they are threatening my world, my security, my refuge. I think of upwelling of reactivity in the last election, and the grasping at this mythic figure of our current president as a way to try to feel more secure in what are often outmoded ways of understanding the world. And he goes on, you can see why conservative people feel very threatened by foreigners, radical ideas, or anything that comes in and challenges the status quo, because one is depending on that world to make one feel secure. When you are threatened, you panic. And I would say, when you panic, then you can lunge at something that you imagine will be your refuge, whether it's a president or anything else. He finishes by saying, the conditioned realm that we perceive, create, and hold on to is a very unstable, uncertain, undependable, and changing condition in itself. That's just the way it is. This is not just a philosophy that the Buddha was expecting us to go along with. We are asked to explore the nature of the conditioned realm in all the dimensions in which we experience it, the physical, the emotional, and the mental. And that's what we're doing, of course, in Zazen or other meditation. One last thing, in Zen consider true awakening, awakening to no self, not talking yourself into the ways that it doesn't make sense to cling to a sense of self, but in direct apprehension of the reality of no self. This is very difficult to describe what that is like. The closest I've ever been able to come to describe it is, it's like a hologram. It's seeing people and things as if holograms. Holograms, you know, these images in thin air that are created with laser technology, where you've seen them in science museums or other museums where there's a face or a whole body, a head or a whole body that is extremely persuasive, convincing that it's a, you know, a celebrity or something, but there's no one there, and this does not require thought process, any process of contemplation about the nature of Buddhist doctrine or all. It's just the direct seeing things, people as they are, there but not there, oneself as there but not there, here but not here. The most joyous, liberating experience, surely, that a human being can have, and worth working for endlessly. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha.